On this week's 51%, a doctor tells what happened when she offered her help during the COVID-19 pandemic.
It's wrong not just to me, but to patients in general on medical marijuana. It's saying that we're lesser than, we're not good enough, that in times of crisis, they still don't want us.
A migraine sufferer shares her journey and hear from a woman who co-founded a community dance class that helps senior citizens fight inactivity and isolation. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. A doctor from Pensacola, Florida, answered the call for healthcare workers to sign up in other states to help with the COVID-19 crisis. The thing is, she ran into an unexpected barrier that she hopes no longer exists the next time such a call arises. 51%'s Bob Barrett has her story.
For weeks, Dr. Alexis Hillman was watching New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's coronavirus briefings and decided she wanted to help. After applying in New York and many other states, she was accepted to work in the COVID-19 field hospital set up at the Baltimore Convention Center in Maryland. Today, Dr. Hillman is back in Pensacola trying to figure out what went wrong.
And the kicker is, I told them even before I left Pensacola, just so it wouldn't be a thing, and it still turned into a thing.
The thing Dr. Hillman is talking about is the fact that she uses medical marijuana.
I actually brought it up, and I said, look, this is something I have. I have a medical marijuana card from Florida. Is this going to be an issue before I make this big trek up there? And they said, you know, as long as you put it on your occupational health paperwork, it shouldn't be an issue. You know, as long as you disclose it. Which I did multiple times.
Medical marijuana was legalized in Maryland in 2014, but the state does not honor other states' cards. In other words, you cannot buy, possess, or use medical marijuana legally in Maryland with a Florida medical marijuana card. And that's when the trouble began. Dr. Hillman, who was an Army veteran with experience working in a field hospital environment, notified her supervisor that she was in town and at her hotel. And then she waited.
Days were going by where I wouldn't hear anything, or, hey, we don't have your badge ready. You know, I was signing up for shifts and I wasn't hearing anything back. And I was getting texts back and forth from my supervisor saying, oh, yeah, you know, things are looking up. And what was the one phrase she used? I'm cautiously optimistic about getting you in here. And it's like, what on earth does that mean? I drove 16 hours here. You shouldn't be cautiously optimistic about anything except me not catching this.
Finally, on Friday morning, April 17th, Dr. Hillman got a call from the occupational health people saying her drug screen came back positive for THC, the active chemical in marijuana.
And I said, yeah, I know. You know, I have medical marijuana. And, you know, they explained why they couldn't hire me. And they asked if I wanted to have a verification test. I'm like, what for? You know, I know it's positive. What are you going to do that for? And they said, well, you can reapply if you enroll in a treatment program. And it's like, why am I going to enroll in a treatment program? Medical marijuana is my treatment.
Before she was sent home, Dr. Hillman did go through orientation and got to interact with other healthcare providers from around the country and compare experiences dealing with the coronavirus. She remembers one conversation very well.
Her name was Lisa. I never got her last name. She was a nurse practitioner, though. And, you know, she was really excited about helping. And we got to compare our experiences in terms of, you know, she had her hours cut, she had her wages cut, you know, she had doctor friends, their wages were getting cut in the midst of all this. And, you know, really getting to see why other people were kind of coming out to help.
Dr. Alexis Hillman is back home now, working her shifts at Pensacola Osteopaths. She hopes that being open about her experience will start a conversation about the stigma still surrounding medical marijuana patients.
I try to make it very clear why I was declined. Not just for appearances, not just so it's like, oh, something bad must have come back in her history. But so they know, like, this is a thing. Moving forward, they know that this is a thing. And so we can start this conversation. Because one of my first thoughts, you know, starting to drive back from Baltimore to Pensacola was, we need to talk about this. This is ridiculous. You're putting out these frantic calls saying, oh, we need people, we need people, we need people. But then someone shows up on medical marijuana and you're like, oh, no, 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 we're fine. We're fine. Go home. It's wrong not just to me, but to patients in general on medical marijuana. It's saying that we're lesser than, we're not good enough, that in times of crisis, they still don't want us.
This little adventure cost Dr. Hillman more than just time and aggravation. She ended up spending close to $1,000 of her own money on hotels and travel expenses and supplies for the month she thought she'd be staying in Baltimore.
It was kind of heartbreaking. And, you know, I had to really kind of come to grasp with it and decide how I was going to let this affect me, because I know I did nothing wrong. I am not doing anything wrong. Doctors are also patients. Doctors also get sick. They come down with physical and mental ailments for which medical marijuana has been recognized to help treat. I told them well in advance. I am not broken. I'm not a stoner. I'm none of these things. I'm just a patient trying to get relief for symptoms. I'm also a doctor, and I don't feel like those two things should be mutually exclusive.
The Field Hospital in Baltimore is being run by Johns Hopkins Medicine. They have not returned several requests for comment. Reporting in Pensacola, I'm Bob Barrett.
Some states have been gradually reopening as they seek to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. Restaurants, retailers, and other businesses in Tennessee began reopening at the end of April. A group of senior citizens in Nashville still had their activity on pause at the time of this show's production. Loneliness and social isolation affect millions of senior citizens across the U.S., and this was before coronavirus, which exacerbated such feelings with social distancing and quarantines. In Nashville's historically black Hadley Park neighborhood, older adults bond over their shared love of an activity that many of them have been doing their entire lives. Here's the story of one of the group's founding members and how she was fighting to keep this community together before COVID-19 hit.
Everyone loves Joanne.
She's an awesome lady.
Joanne Jones is a wife, mother, and grandmother.
Joanne is wonderful and a blessing. Joanne is my inspiration.
But she also has another family, a dancing family.
I consider them my sisters and my brothers. So we're definitely family. It's like one big happy family.
That's Joanne. She turned 79 this month, and she's a founding member of the Hadley Park Line Dancers.
To see the group dancing in unison, everybody together, is beautiful.
But it's also a real workout. Don't be fooled by the fact that most of the group is over 65. They're here to sweat and have fun doing it. It's a free dance class for senior citizens at the Hadley Park Community Center in North Nashville. Joanne started leading the group in 2008. Back then, 10 seniors might show up. These days, they often pack 50, 75, even 100 people into the gym every Tuesday and Thursday morning. The dancers stand side by side in long lines. They dip, they turn, they twist, they slide up and down the basketball court. Volunteer instructors call out the steps, although most of the group knows each song by heart.
I like Push It. I like Jamie Foxx. I like Flashing. I like them all.
Joanne's in her usual spot in the front row. She's wearing sneakers and a lime green shirt with the group's logo printed in sparkles.
I love to dance. And as my husband said, she dances in the kitchen. She dances in... I dance all over the house because I love it.
And do you really? You dance in the kitchen all
yes,
over the house?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. If I hear something come on, the TV or the radio, I'll dance to it. Dancing was just in me because we grew up dancing.
Joanne was born in 1941 and grew up in the Jim Crow era in South Memphis. Her father worked on the railroad to support a family of 12.
All 10 of us went to school, graduated. Even though we were segregated, we had fun growing up.
Some of her best memories from back then happened on Monday nights. That's when all the kids in her neighborhood headed to the YMCA, took off their shoes, and danced. Come on, baby. Let's do
the twist. Come on, what'd you think about it? Did you love it from the beginning?
Loved it. Loved it. And that was one of the criteria. If we behaved, we'd get to go to the sock hop on Mondays. That was our reward.
Joanne and her friends tuned their radios to WDIA, America's first black radio station, and did a dance called the Bop. But these sock hops were about more than just bopping.
So it was really like a reunion to meet, to be together again, and to enjoy something that was fun together.
Do you think about the time when eventually you might have to stop dancing?
I don't think about that. I'm sure, you know, that's inevitable. You know, we all got to get to a point where can't do what you used to do. But I don't even think about that anymore.
But 7 years ago, she was forced to think about it.
It came upon me so sudden that I just felt like my world had just ended.
She was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. The pain in her joints grew more and more severe until she couldn't even walk. She had to use a cane and sometimes even a wheelchair. So dancing at Hadley Park was out of the question.
I felt my life was over. What am I gonna do? All the things that I enjoy so much, I can't do anymore. And I just gave up.
She had to step down from leading the group and stopped coming to class. Worse yet, she didn't know if she would ever be able to come back.
I had a pity party. I was staying in. I was moody. I was crying. And loneliness is one of those feelings that nobody wants to ever have to endure. It's like you're isolated. It's just you.
This is a common feeling among seniors, the isolation that comes with age, not being able to get out and do what you love. But with encouragement from her family at Hadley Park, Joanne's pity party didn't last.
Everything changes when you have that support system. And I am so happy that they are a part of my life. And I'm hoping and praying that they will remain a part of my life.
All right, y'all ready?
She's back in the dance line this morning. But Joanne knows that she and her friends get a little bit older with each Tuesday that passes. Some dance moves are still painful. Doing a twist sometimes bothers the arthritis in her knee. And some of the other founding members have passed away.
And we put on our Hadley Park t-shirts and we go as a group to the services.
It's that kind of family.
It's that kind of family. Illness, death, in the group, we're supported. That's just the way we are. I say, enjoy life because this is the only life you have. Tomorrow's not promised. Have fun. Dance, dance, dance. And more dance.
For the Transom Traveling Workshop and WPLN, I'm David Kondos.
Feels good out here.
David Kondos produced this piece as part of the Transom Traveling Workshop at WPLN in Nashville. Albany, New York resident Nancy Harris-Bonk suffers from migraine headaches a lot. The 58-year-old is a migraine patient advocate and vice president of the nonprofit Chronic Migraine Awareness. Harris-Bonk also founded the Western New York Migraine and Headache Disorder Support Group and is a moderator and contributor at healthunionsmigraine.com.
I first started my migraine journey when I was a teenager. I had migraine attacks around my period. They were easily treated with over-the-counter medications. Then in 1996, when I was carrying my son to the car, I slipped on a patch of black ice, fell backward, and smashed my head on the concrete. and was unconscious for about 20 minutes. He was okay, thankfully, but I had no idea where I was and sustained a traumatic brain injury. That prompted chronic daily migraine and a whole host of other health issues. So being in debilitating pain for years, I needed some relief and went online and looked for information. And that's how I started my journey.
What did you find? What was the difficulty in finding, you know, relief?
Well, the doctors just assumed it was a headache. They really sort of disregarded my pain. You know, she fell, she hit her head, she should be okay. We'll just give her some medication and, you know, send her on her way. That was a problem. It didn't seem that there was anyone who understood how debilitating my pain was. I had to have help raising my two children. Working was out of the picture and has been since I fell. And it was just lack of support and lack of information. So going online allowed me to start getting information from others who were in similar positions and understood what I was going through.
Nancy, how much of this did you find was gender-based, if at all?
Lots of it. Most all of it, I find, is gender-based. Women have migraine almost twice as likely as men, and it's the second most debilitating neurological issue globally, and it affects women in the prime of their life, during their childbearing years, when they're there to make the most money, raising a family.
In that sense, you know, we see commercials, right, for, oh, so I can't remember the name of the drug, you know, for migraine relief. So I'm sure you were faced with at some point, mm-hmm. why don't you just take this medication? It'll be fine.
Well, that's the thing. Those commercials sort of aggravate me because it says you can get back to your regular life when the fact of the matter is migraine medication to prevent a migraine will help reduce the number of attacks and frequency, but it doesn't get rid of migraine altogether. Nothing cures it. It's like other neurological diseases in that aspect that there isn't a cure right now, and the medicine that's out there, like I said, is just to help reduce frequency and severity of attacks. If we manage our triggers, that's helpful, but to identify our migraine attack triggers is a whole another ball of wax, so to speak. It's fairly difficult to identify. And once they're identified, it's hard to make the trade-off on whether we want to have that glass of beer or we want to go out to that rock concert, knowing full well that we may trigger a migraine attack.
Right. And things are individual. I think there are some universals that trigger people who suffer frequent migraine headaches, but there are others. It's just very individual, right? Like
right.
Nuts for some people, especially women.
Absolutely.
Trigger it, right. I suffered nowhere near
right.
the degree that you do, but I had migraines a lot as a teenager, also around my period, and would get aura and things like that when they were really bad, maybe twice a year, which is nothing in comparison. But and to this day, I don't do overhead fluorescent lighting or that kind of lights or strobe lights or things can really trigger something as well. So I know to stay, you're talking about triggers, I know to stay away from them. But I'd like to get to more about the advocacy and about your searching online to help yourself and then encountering, I'm assuming, a community of other sufferers. And how important is that, especially as a woman, to find others who feel the same, that you can commiserate with, share information with, help, talk, that kind of thing?
Right. It's really invaluable to know you're not alone. I speak with patients on a daily basis who think that they're the only ones who experience this. And it's tragic because there's nothing worse than feeling alone, isolated, and that there's nothing you can do. When they can go to these communities and seek out support and information where their families and friends don't get it, we get it as a community.
Nancy, what's your goal here as a patient advocate, as an advocate for migraine and other headaches? Because generally, correct me if I'm wrong, if one suffers from migraine, you tend to get other types of headaches as well. Now, your situation obviously is different in the sense that you had this fallen traumatic brain injury, but I'm assuming there's other headaches involved here.
Right. It's not uncommon for people with migraine to have more than one type of headache disorder. We can have migraine with aura, migraine without aura, tension type headaches. The list, I think there's over 300 types of migraine and headache disorders. In addition to having more than one type of headache, it's not uncommon to have comorbid conditions, which also impacts how we live our daily life. Depression, anxiety, panic, all seem to go hand in hand. It's not that one causes the other, but they can occur at the same time. The goal here is to get the word out and that we need to demand more for migraine because our treatment options are not very good. We can't take a pill and just get back to our daily life. I really strive to educate people that they in fact do have migraine and it can be treated. That's the goal, educating people.
And then how are you treating yourself or being treated?
I started getting Botox in 2016, and it has really helped my migraine attack frequency. My head pain isn't gone altogether, but I can treat some of my attacks with some success, but not all my attacks with total success, if that makes sense.
It does,
I also take other medications to help relieve an attack and muscle aches from other various conditions. Oxygen is used to abort attacks or stop the migraine process, and it's really beneficial for cluster headache attacks. They're just delving into that for migraine attacks now.
This is daily for you to, you know, engage in something online or group or anything. And to me, that's interesting. How long have you been doing this daily? And, you know, if you were to go a day without, I imagine it's like taking away part of someone's daily routine.
Absolutely. I started in 2003. That's when I started searching around for information. And I've been doing it ever since. I started moderating and contributing to various sites. And it feels empty if I'm not online helping someone because the need is so great. People just feel so defeated and so isolated that they really need the support.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the kind of input, maybe some things jump to the top of mind from a few people, you know, who have found your advice, your input, all of that helpful. You know, what kind of feedback do you get?
Well, that they're stunned that they're not alone. They're so enthusiastic that people understand and that we can point them in a direction. And they just, I don't want to get into doctor bashing because we need our fabulous doctors. But if a doctor can't treat you, find someone who will. There's only about 530 doctors who are board certified in headache medicine for over 40 million people in America who have migraine. So the number needs to increase. But most people don't know that there are even doctors who specialize in that.
Obviously, we're living in this overloaded information age, which in a way helps you because you can jump online and do all your research and moderate forums and everything. But by the same token, we're kind of under 24/7 stress. And I'm just wondering if this is exacerbating, if you're finding in the forums and the groups and your research that are being glued to a screen, again, 24/7 lifestyle, are you seeing an uptick in headache sufferers?
I'm not sure if it's an uptick, but it does impact. Stress definitely impacts our migraine attack. There's two schools of thought on that. Some feel that the actual stress is the migraine attack trigger, while others think it may be the things we do or don't do during stressful times that actually will trigger a migraine attack. And by that I mean if we have a work deadline or a big project due, we may be drinking, you know, 10 cups of coffee when we normally drink one, not sleeping regularly, skipping meals, sitting under those fluorescent lights. All those things can certainly trigger a migraine attack for someone.
Sure, absolutely. And I also wanted to know, since we were talking at the beginning about gender and about how there are more female sufferers than men. So how much of this is hormonal? I mean, you and I were talking about around our periods. I mean, clearly, it seems to me there's a hormonal factor. Does that explain kind of the double number of women to men in a sense?
We do know that hormones play a huge role in migraine attacks, but that's not the only role. there's a strong genetic factor. I don't know if you see that in your family, but my family, they used to call them sick headaches, but they were actually migraine attacks. American women, as I said earlier, are twice as likely to have migraine during the prime of their life. So it's real important for them to get a hold of their triggers, understand what they are, and avoid the ones they can, and try to manage the ones they can't. And in this, we need to demand more for our migraine treatment. If anybody needs more information, they can go to demandmoreformigraine.com or seek me out. I'd be happy to help.
Nancy Harris-Bonk is a migraine patient advocate and educator.
100 years ago, American women won the right to vote. I'm Marty Moscoane. This is Women 100, a series celebrating women who made possible a century of progress, women like Indra Nooyi, a business executive named one of the world's most powerful women by Forbes, Fortune, and others. Born in India in 1955, she earned an MBA from Yale, joined PepsiCo in 1994, and became its first woman CEO in 2006. She led a global strategy that more than doubled the company's annual net profits while redirecting PepsiCo toward a goal of more sustainability. Now an Amazon board member, this wife and mother has been outspoken about the difficulty of work-life balance, stressing that women can't have it all without a network of support. Produced by WHYY with Drexel University. For more information, go to whyy.org/women100.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1609.